Oh! His lips together, his breath snorting through his nose, Bo looked at Chet, standing defiantly by the porch rail. "The next time you want a car to chariot some cheap floozy around," he said, "don't come to me. This is the last time." "That's all right with me," Chet said. He locked eyes with his father, who swore and jerked the car into reverse. On the way out, he backed off the twin strips of red concrete that served as a drive and gouged up a stretch of lawn. Chet didn't even bother to laugh. He just looked contemptuously until they were out of sight. Chapter 4 On Monday, he got his job at Magna. $20 a week and a $5 bonus to every player when they won a game. "You don't have to do much but play ball," the man from the smelter said. "Mornings you'll putter around, do whatever the foreman of the bull gang finds for you. Lots of the guys spend half the morning in the can, but we want you to play ball for keeps. You'll go to practice at 3 every afternoon, and twice a week you'll play. We're making it pretty easy for you so we can walk away with that league this summer." It was pretty nifty, Van and Chet agreed. If they won most of their games, they would make close to $100 a month. They were on the gravy boat, plenty of dough to spend. Chet was already backtracking on the marriage business, postponing it in his mind. You couldn't really bank on it, he told Laura. It wouldn't pay to go getting themselves in a hole. But it was not really money that was making him cautious. It was the sign behind the door in his mind, the sign that said Chet Mason isn't 19, he's only 17. It was easy to forget that when he was with Laura, but it kept coming back when he lay in bed and thought about things before sleeping. There was one more week of school, one more game in the high school league. 2 days before he was to pitch against LDS, Laura came up to school after practice, and she and Chet and Van went over to Mad Macy's for a root beer. They were sitting there, smoking cigarettes, just off the edge of the school grounds, when Muddy Pool came by. The next day, both Chet and Van were dropped from the squad. That was a blow, no matter how the two tried to swagger it off. It made them celebrities of a kind, got them kidded in the halls, even made them the center of a righteous and indignant group. Muddy ought to have more loyalty to the school than to throw off his first-string battery right before a crucial game. If East lost this one and West took Granite, then LDS would win the championship. Muddy ought to be able to overlook smoking. What was a cigarette, anyway? All that was pleasant enough. But still, Chet was sullen when he went up to the field and sat in the bleachers to watch the game. He didn't even bother to hunt up Van. Obscurely, he hoped that something would go wrong, that the team would get in a hole and Muddy would have to come up in the stands and ask him to get in there and save the day. At the end of the second inning, he saw his father come down the cement steps and find a seat, and before the end of an inning, rise and go out again. Probably he had found out from somebody why Chet wasn't pitching. Now there'd be a big blow-up at home. "God damn," Chet said, and sat glumly watching his team pound the LDS pitcher for 3 runs in the third and 2 in the fourth. Hinch, a little squirt with not half the stuff Chet had, settled down after giving up 1 run in the first and had yielded only 4 hits by the time Chet got disgusted and left. "It serves you right," his father said at supper that night. "It serves you damn well right. You had a chance and you blew it. Maybe it'll teach you something." "Rub it in," Chet said. "Maybe I need to rub it in. Maybe if it isn't rubbed in, it'll run right off your thick hide." "Oh, let it drop," Chet said. "It isn't worth making all this fuss about. It doesn't matter to you, huh?" Chet raised his eyes. "Not very much." "No," his father said, his voice acid with contempt. "I guess it wouldn't at that. The only thing that'd matter to you is running around with this flapper of yours every night until 1, 2 o'clock. "Don't you call her a flapper," Chet said. His father looked at him a moment. "All right. She isn't a flapper. She just doesn't know when to go home to bed. Hasn't she got anybody to tell her she can't stay out all night every night?" "Oh, all night. 2 last night, his father said. 1:30 the night before. 3 the night before that. You haven't been in before midnight for a week." "Oh, bourgeois. Yes, bourgeois. You haven't.
Bo, Elsa said.
To Chet, she said,
you have been staying out awful late. It's not good for you while you're growing, and you don't get your studying done.
I do my studying at school, Chet said, and for gosh sake, I'm through growing.
Well, she said, smiling, we'd like to see you once in a while. You might stay home one night a week.
Okay, okay, he said. I'll stay home tonight. I'll sit here and twiddle my thumbs till 10 o'clock and go to bed.
He had a date with Laura, but he was so mad at his family for grinding him down and so sore about the game that he just called her instead, sitting in the hall from 8:15 till 9 o'clock, with his lips confidentially close to the mouthpiece and his voice secret and soft. When he finally hung up, he stretched elaborately and yawned.
Well, it's almost 9, he said. Time for big athletes to go Betty-bye.
His father did not rise to his sarcasm, and his mother only said, smiling, I guess it wouldn't do you any great harm.
So he went, and for an hour lay imagining how it would have been if LDS had cracked down on Hinch right at the beginning, and the sub-catcher had let a pitch through him and allowed a run to come in, and the whole battery had fallen apart, and runs had kept coming across, so that Muddy had to come leaping up in the stands and get Chet and Van right down in their street clothes to save the day. He could hear the crowd yelling, 9 for Mason, 9 for Horsley, and he saw himself towing the rubber in street shoes, rolling up his sleeves and going to it, and the succession of strikeouts, his fast one burning in there so fast that Van shook his mitt hand and grinned when he tossed the old apple back. Not a hit, not a walk, after his appearance in the fifth. Not an LDS runner to reach first, while East whittled away at the big lead and got 2 here, 1 there, till they tied it up. It would have been something to come up in the 8th or 9th with the score tied and slam one down the right field line for 2 or 3 bases, driving Van in from 2nd with the winning run, and have Van wait at home to shake his hand and pound him on the back. Then the 2 of them would walk off with the crowd yelling. Muddy would have to come up and stick out his hand and admit that when he threw them off the squad, he threw away his ball club, and then they would have shaken hands and lighted up a cigarette right in his face. But instead of that, East had won 7-2. The sub-catcher hadn't made a single error, and Hinch had held LDS to 6 hits, the little pipsqueak. Then graduation. He and Bruce graduating together, the assembly hall full of parents and all the little high school girls running around halls and lawns in their first formals, the long meeting when you sat and waited your turn to go up on the stage and get your football sweater, walking across and taking it from Muddy's hand and going back and sitting down, while the applause died for you and started for the next one. Muddy couldn't cheat him out of that sweater anyway. He'd earned that one. Catching that 4th-quarter pass and beating Provo 6-0, and taking a kickoff 80 yards against Brigham City, and completing 7 passes for 3 touchdowns against Granite. He'd earned that one, and plenty. And he sat in the row of athletes holding the sweater box in his lap, wondering if just maybe they'd give him a baseball letter, too. He'd earned that, too, the potlickers. East wouldn't have taken the championship if he hadn't won 3 games for them. But probably Muddy would hold a grudge and not even read his name off. The football candidates were finished. The basketball team had gone up one after another. The midget basketball team had climbed the stage to the accompaniment of polite clapping and snickers from the audience. Bruce was one of the little guys. He looked puny and skinny, even though he had suddenly started to grow in the last year and had shot up a couple of inches. Chet felt a little ashamed that his brother was such a runt. Probably he could have done all right in high school if he'd been bigger. He wasn't bad at anything for his size. The superintendent of public instruction was introduced and stood up to present the Silver Loving Cup representing the baseball championship to Muddy Poole. Muddy made a little speech. It was all due to the fellows. They had got in there and worked like mad and played the game clean and hard, and sat down. The names of the baseball team started, and the line where Chet sat began to shift as boys worked their way out to the aisles. Chet crossed his hands on his football sweater box and sat still.
He almost caught himself breaking into a whistle. Van, down the row, turned and winked. Then Muddy read off Van's name. Van shot a look at Chet, stood up, marched down the aisle, and was given a sweater. Muddy read off others: Longabaugh, McKay, Mason. Chet stood up and marched. Muddy, his face perfectly straight, held out the box and said, without moving his lips, "I ought to charge you $10 for this, you stinker." Chet grinned, conscious of the audience at his back, the row of teachers and dignitaries along the stage. "Horse collar," he said, in the same stiff-lipped, deadpan whisper. Muddy shoved the box hard in his belly as a quarterback tucks the ball into the arms of a halfback coming around on a reverse, and Chet put his head down and made a play of running it off stage for a touchdown. There were some smiles, some looks of formal surprise on the faces along the stage, some laughter from the audience. Chet skinned back into his seat over the crowded legs. Muddy was all right, a good guy. That was the cream of the assembly as far as Chet was concerned. But there were a lot of other awards, pins for publications and opera and glee club and student offices. Chet was up twice more for opera and glee club, and then once again with the glee club when it sang. Then the speakers, the valedictorian and the salutatorian and the superintendent of schools and the commencement speaker, and the long queues forming for the passing out of the diplomas. And that was the end of that. That was the end of school, of stinking chem labs, of physics classes where you experimented with the laws of the pendulum, swinging plumb bobs on strings down the stairwell from the third floor to the basement, so that girls going into the door of the girls' gym could be bopped with them. Now was the end of practices after school, of showers in the steamy old shower room and towel fights between the lockers, of snake dances through the streets to celebrate victories, of operas in the old Salt Lake Theater, where you sang tenor leads in Mademoiselle Modiste or The Red Mill. This was the end of lunches on the lawns while the gulls flew over, crying, of butts snitched behind the corner of Mad Maisie's, of hot dogs and mustard and root beer over her messy counter, of toting a gun in ROTC drills, and marching on hot spring days up through the Lucerne toward the mountains, a whole battalion breaking ranks sometimes and tearing through the alfalfa when a racer snake slid from under the file closer's feet, all of them chasing the swift snake while the student officers yelled their heads off and howled commands that nobody minded and tossed around demerits that nobody listened to, and the commandant started back from Company A to see what was the matter. Now was the end of a lot of things. He held the rewards of the year in his hands and lap, sat among his fellows as he could now no longer, in quite the same way, sit among them. He was through school, grown up. It had been all right, but he didn't want any more of it. Bruce said he was going on to college. Let him be the grind of the family. There was more fun in the world than that. There was his ball-playing job this summer, the possibility in the future of a tryout with the bees, and the big leagues ahead. And in the back of the hall somewhere, back where the first sharp spats of clapping started whenever his name was called to go up for an award, was Laura. And Laura was somehow the symbol of the end of all this. He turned his head and looked at the boys along the row, whispering together, snickering, telling jokes. Kids. Nothing but kids. His mother and father and Bruce were standing together near the arc light, under the row of little planted maples, when he came out with Laura. For a moment he would have slipped away if he could have, but the crowd was shoving behind him. He took Laura's arm. "Come on," he said. "You want to meet my folks?" "Oh, gee," Laura said. She made quick dabs at her hair and peeked into her compact mirror. "Do I look all right?"
"You look swell."
"I'm scared," she said. "What if they don't like me?"
"If they don't, that's their tough luck."
He was a little nervous himself, for fear his old man would make some break, be grouchy about something. But it was all right. His father was dressed up fit to kill, black and white shoes, Panama hat, diamond in his tie, and his mother wore her best dress, the one that had cost $80 and had been bought over her protests when the old man had a fit of generosity. Chet was glad she had it anyhow. It looked nice. And you could always depend on Ma to be kind. She smiled at him and took Laura's hand, and it was all right. His father kidded them. Didn't Laura feel a little funny going around with a big shot? She'd be lucky to kiss the hem of his garments now. He took off his Panama and clapped it on Chet's head. "How's the head size?" he said. "All right." "Good," his old man said. He kept looking out over the crowd, standing big and broad as a bridge pier, while the crowd swirled around him. He seemed abstracted, almost embarrassed. His eyes met Chet's, wandered away, came back again.
"Well, you've got more education now than either your mother or I had," he said to Chet and Bruce. "Let's see what you can do with it."
They looked at him and moved their lips, murmuring something.
"It's a big night for both of you," Elsa said. "I'm proud of you both." She turned to Laura. "They're pretty good boys, both of them, even if they are so homely," she said, and her smile asked Laura into the family, made her part of the circle.
"Homely," Laura said. "I think they're two of the best-looking boys in school."
"Now my head size is going up," Chet said.
Bruce kept looking at Laura.
"I hate to be classed with him," he said. "He looks like something you'd find in a rat trap, like old second-hand cheese."
"I could think of something you look like," Chet said, "but I'm too polite to mention it here."
"You look a good deal alike to me," Elsa said. "How does that suit you?"
"Rotten," Bruce said.
"Lousy," said Chet.
He reached over and took a poke at Bruce.
"So you graduated from high school," he said. "When you gonna get your first long pants?"
"Horse collar," Bruce said.
They were all grinning, and it was a good feeling to be standing there all dressed up, something accomplished, everybody friendly and horsing around.
"Mama," Beau Mason said, "maybe we ought to take these young fry out to celebrate. Where should we go?"
"Where do they want to go?" Elsa said.
"Where do you want to go?" Chet said to Laura.
"Gee," she said, "I ought to go home, really."
"Oh, bourgeois, how about a show?"
"It's pretty late, isn't it?"
"Not late at all," Beau Mason said. "I often stay out after 10.
"Well, all right," she said, laughing.
"Haven't you got a girl, Bruce?" Elsa said. "Wouldn't you like to take somebody?"
"No, I guess not."
"Bruce is scared of girls," Chet said.
He tucked Laura's arm boldly under his.
"There's a half dozen chase him around all the time, but he don't wanna."
"Go lay a nice rough fire brick," Bruce said.
They went to the movies, and after the movies they stopped for ice cream, and on the way back to the car they passed a shooting gallery, and Bruce and Chet and their father shot for Cupid dolls. Bruce won, and his father looked at him in something like amazement.
"He's been practicing up all spring on the rifle team," Chet said.
"Yeah," his brother said, "and even when I'm out of practice I'll take you on any old time."
"This seems funny," Elsa said. "Remember back in Dakota when you won me a lot of cupies and pennants and things at the carnival in Devil's Lake?"
"I was shooting a little better that day," Beau said.
"I guess. That was the day you won the state traps championship."
"Really?"
Laura said.
"He just looks that way," Chet said, and poked his father's shoulder, solid as a wall. "He used to be a shooter and a ball player and all sorts of things. Never think it to look at him now."
His father let loose a stinging cuff that just grazed Chet's ear, and they sparred on the sidewalk, horsing around like kids, until Chet got self-conscious and quit. His father's iron arm stuck out to jolt him one.
"Get on any time," his father said, holding the arm out straight. "Do some trick bar stuff. Chin yourself. Let me know when you do, though, so I don't forget you're there and drop you."
"Gee," Laura said later, when he took her in. "I think your family's swell. Your dad is a good egg."
"He's all right," Chet said.
"And your mother's so sweet. I just love her."
"So do I," Chet said.
"See you tomorrow?"
"After class?"
"Okay,
I'll meet you there."
He went back to the car and got in, and on the way home they all sang. It was funny, Chet thought as he got into bed. It was darn funny how the old man changed. One minute he was the damnedest old crab on earth, ordering you around and bawling you out, and the next he was a hell of a good guy. You could depend on Ma to be right in there any time, even if she felt lousy, but you could never tell about the old man. He guessed that the old man was pretty proud of his kids tonight. Maybe that explained it. He stewed around and raised hell, but he wanted you to be something all the time. And because he had never got past the 8th grade himself, he thought education was the clear stuff. That was a laugh. He ought to go into a study hall sometime. Still, it was sort of nice to know that the old man was proud of you. It made you feel as if everything was all right. As he dropped off to sleep, he had a curious feeling that his old man's pride was somehow the best thing in the whole day. Now summer, the best part of the year. Rising at 6:30, you could hear the birds making a great clatter in the backyard and see robins running, their heads cocking sideways to listen, their beaks digging down hard and their legs bracing, and the night crawlers coming out of the grass, stretching and hanging on. You could smell the morning smell of sprinkled lawns and hear from across the street the whir of a lawnmower. And as you ate breakfast alone in the kitchen, the Tribune thudded on the front porch, and you went to get it, propping it against the milk bottle as you ate. You went out tiptoeing so as not to wake the family, and your chest couldn't hold all the air it wanted. And at the corner, in the first light of the sun just breasting the Wasatch, you leaned against a tree and had your first cigarette of the day. In the early morning, the sounds that at midday were an indistinct and blurred overtone were distinct and clear. The rumble of a truck coming down the unpaved hill past the old brewery, the even clop of a milk horse, the whistling of the little Sheeny opening his doors and running down his awning halfway up the block, the thud of a flat wheel on the streetcar as it came around the upper curve and started down toward your corner. As you swung aboard, your nose gave up the whiff of honey locust it had been smelling, and smelled instead the familiar dust and ozone and oil smell of the streetcar. And you went to find a seat between the men with lunch pails like your own on their laps. At 3rd South and State, you got off to join the other guys waiting for the smelter truck. If merchandise was being unloaded into the sidewalk doors of Auerbach's store, you ran hurdle races over bales and cartons. If you got there early and there was nothing else to do, you could horse the deaf and dumb newspaper vendor who came up to wave his papers in your face and make his ungodly noises. When you just stood looking across the street and pretended you didn't hear, he would get furious, thrust a paper right under your nose, almost jump up and down. Then you could act surprised, eye him coldly, say, "What?" Put one hand up around your ear. You could always get a laugh from people going by, and it sure made the old guy mad. Work at the mill was a joke. Half the time you couldn't have found anything to do if you'd wanted to. You just sat and threw the old bull around, or chucked rocks at tin cans, or went up to the roofless back house and read a magazine until somebody hammered on the door and threatened to tip you over if you didn't get the hell out. About 3, you went out and peppered the ball around, held battery practice, batting practice, infield practice, fungoed out flies. Generally, you got up a game of rounders for the last half hour before the 5:30 truck pulled out. On the way into town, you could generally talk the driver into stopping at Otto's on 39th South for a pitcher of homebrew, the whole gang of you storming into Otto's parlor to guzzle his cold black beer, pouring some into a saucer for the cat and watching him get tight, hanging around till the truck driver got scared he'd be called for staying on the road too long. You got home about 6:30 in time for a shower before supper, while Bruce crabbed at you for not getting home in time to do your share of lawn mowing, and your old man sat on the porch reading the telegram and going out once in a while to move the sprinkler around the lawn. If you didn't have a date with Laura, you telephoned her until someone wanted the phone. It made the old man sore sometimes to have you hang onto the phone for an hour, but what the hell. It was a swell life, and he was pitching good ball. Never got into trouble once, except when Tuella Reuters started shooting a mirror into his eyes from the stands. That made him so mad he blew up entirely, walked 2 men, allowed 3 hits, and Wild pitched another run home before the manager jerked him. All the dagoes and greasers and wops and bohunks in the Tooele stands razzed the hell out of him, giving him the old hip-hip as he walked off. But that was the only time anything had gone wrong. He had won 2 games, saved another for Pearson, and lost only that one, and his team was tied for the lead at 6-1 and 2 lost. It was a swell life. The best part of it was the secret part. The nights with Laura, at Lagoon, at Saltaire, at movies. Times when they borrowed Van's bug, or went out with Van and some girl and drank beer, coming home loud and late, parking under the poplars of some dark street and growing quiet, necking. It was hard to find anywhere to go to make love, really. The cockpit of a bug was no place, especially if you were really in love and your girl didn't like the idea of being jammed up in a seat and maybe some snooper or cop come by and flash a light on you. Laura was always cautious when Van was around anyway. She thought he talked too much. Then they moved. It made little difference to Chet, except that now he had to walk 2 blocks to the car line. But it made a difference when his mother broke down and had to go up in the mountains to Brighton for a rest. That meant he was camping in the house with Bruce and his father. And when Bruce went up to Brighton, too, to live in a tent below the inn, then Chet and his father were the only ones left. They got their own meals, or ate out. Because of his father's business, they had never had a maid or a cook. After a while, when Chet had got home too late, and the supper his father had fixed was all cold, and the old man mad about it, they quit making believe they were keeping house. Chet left before his father was up, came home often to find the house empty, went out again to see Laura, and came home late, and often for 2 days at a time they didn't even see each other. The old man couldn't stay around the house much, it gave him the jim-jams, so that often he stayed out till midnight just to avoid being in the place alone. "The damn place is like a morgue," he said. "I wish to hell your mother would get well." "So do I," Chet said. "You going up Sunday to see her?"
"Yes."
"Maybe I'll come along," Chet said. He really ought to. She'd been up there 2 weeks, and he hadn't even written her a letter. He'd been going to, but then Bruce went up, and there didn't seem any point in a letter as long as he was there. "Maybe Laura could come along," he said. "Is that all right? Can't you go anywhere without her in your hip pocket?" "I don't see that it'd be so awful to take her along."
"All right, take her along. Only don't forget you're going up there to see your mother, not squire your Laura around."
"Don't worry," Chet said. "I guess I appreciate Ma as much as you do."
Chapter 5 The sun was slow coming over the mountains. The bedroom in the log lodge was cold, and she dressed shivering. But there was always a fire in the huge rock fireplace on the mezzanine where she had breakfast, and when she went out on the second-floor balcony and around the corner into the early sun, she stepped from cool to warm instantly, as if the bar of shadow the corner threw was an insulating wall. There was a dewy smell of balsam fir, and the air was so high and pure that it made her light-headed. Sitting on the balcony in the mornings, waiting for Bruce to come up from his camp, she could see out over the whole little settlement, the old collapsing frame hotel, the glint of Silver Lake beyond it, the Twin Lakes foot trail, a brown line against the green mountainside. It was fun to sit and look up a half mile past timberline to the snow that still lay in northern crevices, and to let her eyes swing around the whole circular rim of the divide, over the fir and aspen that floored the cirque, over the peaks, sharp and clean, between her and the farther sky. A smoke always went up from the girls' camp on Lake Catherine, a straight feather among the trees, and sometimes there was a distant rumble of blasting from Park City, 9 miles over the divide. Chipmunks ran along the top rail of the balcony, looking for peanuts or crumbs. The first time she got one to come into her lap for a nut, she laughed aloud for the pure joy of having made friends with something. She felt guilty for having so much fun. Poor Beau and Chet were batching down in town in the heat, the house probably a mess, nobody to get their meals. She ought to go back down and take care of them. But she didn't really want to. The way she lived up here, everything done for her, the balsam smell good in her nostrils even while she slept,
reading a little and walking a little and napping a little in the afternoons, was a condition so unusual and pleasant that the thought of breaking it off was like Sunday morning awakening to a lazy sleeper. Let it go on a little while longer. Bruce came whistling along the road and stopped under the balcony to look up at her, his face a thin brown wedge. He had a camera on a strap over his shoulder and a loose, almost empty knapsack in his hand.
"How do, madame?" he said. "Feeling pretty spry?"
"Spry as a cricket," she said. "I think every morning is more wonderful than the last one.
How'd you sleep?"
"Like a log.
Eat a good breakfast?"
"Enormous," she said, and patted her stomach.
"Let's see your tongue."
She stuck her tongue out, leaning over the balcony rail, and he squinted up at it.
"I guess you're all right," he said. "Want to go for a walk?"
"I was just hoping you would. It's such a lovely morning.
I know a good trail up around the edge of Mount Majestic. Once you get up the slope, you walk along under the aspens for a mile or so. It's pretty nice, only it's a little far."
"Let's go," she said.
"I feel as if I could walk all day."
Up the long trail through the firs, they walked slowly. In openings along the trail, the columbines were pure and tall and white, sometimes a space of half an acre, solidly white with them. Farther up, as they climbed a brown, rooty path around the flank of the mountain, the columbines were not so large, not so tall, but their petals were touched with the palest blue and pink, like the blush of blood through a transparent skin.
"It's the altitude," Bruce said. "When you get up high, they get that tinge."
"I know I shouldn't pick any," Elsa said. "But do you suppose one each would matter?"
"I guess not," he said, seriously. "They only reproduce from seed, and a lot of old dames come up here and pick an armful, and then there aren't any more."
"I don't want to be an old dame then, I guess," she said. "Here."
He picked her one of each color, and she folded them into her book, amused at his solemn air of being the personal caretaker of the whole mountain, and very fond of him. They came over a steep hump that had her warm and breathless, her legs tired, and before them lay a level trail cut through the aspen. Through the thin trees on the lower edge of the trail she could look over a long oceanic roll of ridges and peaks, a forested valley stretching southward, the blue glimmer of water. Clouds like cotton wool coasted over the peaks on the Alta side, snagged on spines of rock, blew eastward in frayed strings.
"Those are the Ontario Lakes," Bruce said, pointing. "The valley is Bonanza Flat."
Elsa sat down on a stone, filling her eyes with green and blue distance. The sun through the thin aspen leaves was warm, the earth was fragrant with bark and mold and bitter leaf smell.
"Oh, dear," she said, "I don't ever want to go back."
"How'd a cabin be right here?" Bruce said. "With that view in your eye, you could ski on over to Park City when you needed supplies in winter and stay the year round. You build it sometime and I'll come be your housekeeper."
"I'd like to," Bruce said. "Don't ever think I wouldn't." His eyes, she thought, were strangely dark and brooding. You could never tell what he was thinking. He steered you off when you got close.
"What made you say that?"
"What?" "What you just said."
"I don't know," he said. "I'd like it, wouldn't you?"
"It might be a pretty hard life."
"That kind of hard life is easier than a lot of other kinds," he said.
He stared down over the twinkling trees, flowing like bright water down the slope into Bonanza Flat. "Last time I came across here, it was raining cats and dogs," he said. And Elsa understood that he had changed the subject. That was all he was going to say about that other, whatever it was.
"When was that?" she said.
"Last year. That was the day after we spent the night in the Park City jail."
"What?"
"Sure. We went over to a ball game, walked over along the old tramway, and in the afternoon it rained so we couldn't walk back. We didn't have any money, so we asked a cop what to do, and he let us sleep in the jail."
"For goodness sake," she said, "you never told me about that."
"Sure I did."
"You never did."
She shivered her shoulders.
"That's the last place I'd ever want to sleep," she said. "I'd rather walk in the rain."
It was all right. The cockroaches were a little bad.
Arms hooked around his hunched-up knees, he looked down across the valley, and Elsa watched him with pity, knowing that what had been in his mind a minute before was sullenness about his father's business, bitterness that the days weren't always like this. She couldn't have told how she knew what was in his mind. Perhaps that reference to jail. There had been a shadow on her own thoughts instantly at that word.
"Well," she said, "shall we walk some more?"
"I don't care. How do you feel?"
"Maybe we'd better start back," she said. "Pa may come up to have Sunday dinner with us, and it's getting on toward 11 now."
It was a curious feeling for Elsa to come down the trail and see Bo and Chet pitching horseshoes beside the inn, with Laura watching. She saw them objectively as she would see strangers. Bo, big and dark, getting a little heavier, his Panama on the back of his head and the diamond glittering in his tie when he turned sideways in the sun. Chet, not as tall but broad, very deep in the chest, his arms heavy and muscular under his rolled-up sleeves. Almost in surprise, she thought,
"Why, he's really a very handsome boy."
Everything about him looked clean and strong, and there was Laura along. That was getting to be quite a romance, almost too much time spent on one girl. Laura turned and saw her, waved. The horseshoe pitchers stopped.
"Hi, Ma," Chet said. "How you feeling?"
She kissed him, then Bo, put out her hand to Laura.
"Oof, we've walked a long way," she said,
and sat down on the step to fan herself.
"You're up here for a rest," Bo said, frowning. "You don't want to overdo it."
"I'm having a lovely rest," she said. "How do you two get along at home?"
"I never see this guy from one week's end to the next," Bo said.
"Oh, horse," Chet said, "I'm home more than you are."
"Neither one of us wears the place out living in it," Bo said. "When you going to get well and come home, Mama?"
"I don't know. The doctor said 2 months, but I feel fine now. Rested as can be." "You look better, I think," Laura said. "I noticed it right away, lots better."
"Really," Elsa said, "I'm glad I don't look worse. That would be pretty hard on my family."
"When do they eat around this place?" Chet said.
"It ought to be pretty quick now. Did you make a reservation?"
"I'd better go do that," Bo said,
but Elsa rose.
"I'll do it. I have to go tidy up anyway. You want to come with me, Laura?"
"Sure,"
Laura said. A very quiet girl, Elsa thought. Yet there was something there she vaguely disliked. As if her quiet were put on, as if it wasn't quite her own face she wore. Or maybe the hungry way she looked at Chet, or the very slight, dissatisfied wrinkle between her eyes. While she took off her walking dress, Elsa could see her in the mirror.
"How's Chet been pitching?"
she said.
"I don't see the paper very often up here." "He's done swell," Laura said. "He's only lost one game."
"Fine,"
Elsa said, with her mouth full of hairpins. She shook her hair down and brushed it hard. Laura sat with her hands in her lap, nervously swinging her foot.
"You've got beautiful hair," she said.
"It's the one thing I ever had that doesn't seem to fade or wear out," Elsa said. She looked at Laura in the mirror, saw her hungry eyes, the look almost of weeping around the mouth.
"Don't you feel well?" she said, turning.
Laura wet her lips.
"Oh, yes, I feel all right."
"I thought for a minute you might be ill," Elsa said. To her dismay, the girl jumped up from the bed and threw her arms around her, her face twisted.
"Oh, Mrs. Mason," she said. "Why, what is it?" "I wish I had a mother like you," Laura said.
She buried her face in Elsa's shoulder and clung when Elsa tried gently to break her loose.
"Let's be sensible," she said. "You have your own mother."
"But she isn't like you," Laura wailed. "She's always after me for something and suspicious of me, and she isn't pretty at all. She's fat."
"Well," Elsa said, "I'm sure she's..."
"You don't know,"
Laura said. She turned and sat on the bed again, dabbing at her averted eyes. She said without looking up,
"You just don't know how it is to have a family that's vulgar and bullying.
I see how pleasant everything is in your family, and how kind you are, and how they all love you, and you love them, and how nice Mr. Mason is, and I can't help it. I wish I had a family like yours." "Why, you poor child," Elsa said. The thought of anyone's envying their family life was so wild that she wanted to laugh. "We have to be satisfied with what we have," she said. "Maybe your mother is tired or overworked." She watched Laura's bent head. "Maybe you're poor," she said. "I know all about that. It's hard to keep pleasant when things go wrong all the time."
"We aren't poor," Laura said sullenly. "We have enough. But we're just not kind like you. We don't get along. I don't know why it is."
"Love is a thing that works both ways," Elsa said quietly. "We have to give other people a chance to love us before we find them lovable sometimes."
Laura stood up and tried to laugh.
"I'm silly. I don't know what got the matter with me all of a sudden."
Elsa went back to putting up her hair, watching the girl in the mirror. She was a rather helpless, pretty thing, and obviously unhappy. But her unhappiness was obscurely annoying, too. There was the edge of spite in it, the eagerness to blame someone else for her misery, that would have made one want to shake her if she had been one's own. She turned and faced the girl squarely.
"Is it because you're in love with Chet?" she said. "Don't your family like him?"
"Oh, they like him all right."
"But you are in love with him," Elsa said.
Laura nodded, keeping her head down.
"How does Chet feel about it?"
Laura nodded again, unwilling to meet Elsa's eyes. Elsa sighed.
"There's no reason you shouldn't go together, as long as you aren't foolish about it. When you're both old enough to get married, you probably won't even like each other anymore. But if you do, nobody will try to stop you from marrying in a few years."
Laura lifted tragic eyes, but said nothing, and Elsa frowned.
"You children aren't serious now."
Her eyes full of utterly disproportionate terror, Laura pushed herself back on the bed.
I don't know."
Elsa took her hand and pulled her to her feet.
"Good heavens, don't be afraid of me. I didn't mean to scare you. I just wanted to be sure you and Chet weren't going to be foolish about waiting. Waiting isn't too hard when you can see each other all the time. Nobody's trying to keep you apart, child."
"Oh, Mrs. Mason," Laura said, and began to cry. "I'm so unhappy."
Elsa stood waiting, but the girl said no more. So Elsa said it herself, the words heavy and sodden and hard to lift.
"You and Chet haven't got in trouble, have you?"
"No,"
Laura said.
"Oh, no, nothing like that."
"Well, then everything will turn out all right. You've got your whole lives ahead of you. You shouldn't be unhappy at your age." But she was thinking as they went downstairs that Laura had been playing some kind of double game, had been trying to say something she was afraid to say, and at the same time had been angling for sympathy, trying to ingratiate herself by appearing miserable and picked on, as if to justify that other thing that she hadn't dared to say.
"Poor child," she thought automatically.
Kids in love gave themselves endless troubles for nothing. But she didn't like the idea of Chet's being involved with this girl as deeply as he apparently was. He was too young. He didn't know enough. She had hardly phrased her automatic pity for Laura before the phrase had twisted itself in her mind into something else.
"Poor Chet."
She watched Chet at dinner, kept glancing up to intercept looks between him and Laura. They did not act like kids out for a good time. They were sober, their eyes and their occasionally touching hands eloquent of secrets. The thing was obviously serious, but how serious it was hard to tell. "But two children like that," she thought. Chet was only 17. Still, he was in deep. He wasn't full of horseplay the way he ordinarily was. He hardly laughed at all except with his sly, sidelong look at Laura. There was something brooding and almost deadly in the way the two looked at each other.
"Oh, Lord," she said, "why are they so intent on ruining their own lives?"
After dinner, Bo was playing the slot machines while Laura and Bruce watched, and she crooked her finger at Chet. As they walked away, she felt Laura's eyes on her back. Everything that happened, the slightest incident, was significant to those two, pertinent to some guarded secret of their own.
"Let's sit down," she said.
The mezzanine was empty. The other guests were all out on the porch, their voices a dim buzzing through the doors. Finding it hard to begin, not knowing exactly what she had brought him up here to say to him, Elsa took his hand.
"You've got paws just like your father's," she said. "It doesn't seem any time at all since they were making mud pies."
Chet said nothing. He waited.
"Chet," she said, "what about Laura?"
She could feel the stiffness of his body through his hand. His eyes were veiled as if she were an enemy.
"What about her?"
"She talked to me a little before dinner up in my room." Instantly there was life in the veiled eyes.
"What did she say?"
"What could she have said?" The eyes went dull again.
"I don't know,"
he said, and shrugged slightly.
"She said she was in love with you," Elsa said.
Chet tried to laugh.
"Good," he said. "She never told me that."
"Oh, Chet," his mother said and stood up impatiently. "You needn't try to duck and hide from me. I just want to talk to you openly and see if I can't give you some good advice."
"People are always awful free with advice," Chet said. "Have I been?
You're always worrying about what time I come in and stuff like that. You can't get over thinking of me as a kid."
"I was thinking more about your health than anything else."
"Oh, my health. I'm healthy as a horse. No guy wants to be mothered and babied around. I've got to grow up sometime."
"Not too soon," she said softly. "Not so soon you'll spoil your whole life by it. I'm not trying to hold you back, Chet. You're old for your age in some ways, but you're still only 17, and you can ruin your life by getting too serious with a girl too soon. I'm just asking you to remember that you aren't really a man till you're 21. Lots of boys aren't till later than that." His ears were pink, his brows pulled down in a black frown. At least she had got the mask off him, she thought, wearily, but it didn't do any good.
"I can look after myself," he said. "I know enough to come in out of the rain." He said it angrily, but he did not quite meet her eyes, and she read him as if he were an 8-year-old trying to bluster his way out of trouble. Underneath that anger, he was uncertain and scared. He knew he was in deep.
"We're getting altogether too serious," she said lightly. "I didn't bring you up here to croak at you. I just wanted to remind you to keep yourself free and clean. If you want to be a ball player, you'll have to be free for a few years, Chet."
"Yeah," he said. "I don't know what got you thinking I wasn't going to be."
"Laura."
"Oh," he said. He looked past her, the dull and sullen look on his mouth. "Shall we go on down again?" he said. For a moment, Elsa looked at him, feeling that she wanted to cry. He was just like Bo, as stubborn and immovable as a wall, as unwilling to admit a mistake. What he did was right. It had to be. Out of her anger and irritation came a curious desire to reach out and hug him. But that would have been as embarrassing and bothersome to him as her attempt to give advice. She turned and went downstairs. She did not want to be an interfering mother, but she was determined that if there was anything she could do to prevent his making a fool of himself, she would do it, short of actual compulsion.
"What about speaking to Bill Talbot about Chet?"
she asked Bo out on the porch later.
"Couldn't you get him a chance to try out with the bees? He's been doing so well out in the Copper League."
"He isn't ready for any Double-A League," Bo said. "When he's ready, they'll be after him themselves. Besides, you don't try out in the middle of the summer. They look over the young guys in the spring in training camp."
"But what do you want him pushed so fast for?"
Bo said, irritated. "Let him grow up a little. He'd just blow his chance."
"Bo," she said, I wish you'd talk to Bill just the same.
His brows drew down, and he turned to stare. What's on your mind?
With her eyes, she indicated Chet and Laura leaning over the balcony rail. Chet was pointing at something, and Laura was bent close to him, trying to see. I think it would do Chet a lot of good to get away from Salt Lake for a while, Elsa said. Bill's a good friend of yours. He'd do it for you as a favor, even if we had to pay Chet's expenses.
Bo jerked his head at the oblivious two. You think?
I don't know. I'm afraid they're both pretty far gone.
At 17, he said, and snorted through his nose.
It doesn't do any good to talk to him, Elsa said. I've tried. If you tried, you'd just make him bullheaded. But if you could get Bill to let him go along with the team, maybe pitch for batting practice or something.
Yeah, Bo said. Well, I'll see. But I wouldn't expect too much. Bill's the best judge of when he wants to look anybody over.
They looked at each other, and both laughed.
It was funny, in a way, how they schemed on one end of the balcony while Chet and Laura plotted heaven only knew what on the other.
I guess they never get too old to need taken care of, Elsa said. How's business going?
Yesterday, Bo said, I bought another $1,000 worth of U.S. steel.
How much does that make?
He winked. Mama, he said, we may not be as rich as we'd be if we played the market right, but we've got $18,000 worth of stock in that safety deposit box, and we own every nickel's worth of it.
$18,000, Elsa said. It seemed an enormous sum.
I figured up our assets the other day, Bo said. We're worth pretty close to $30,000, counting everything. Give me time to multiply that by 10 and we'll retire.
Elsa smiled. Remember when you first started? You said you'd make a few trips and get a stake and get into some business. Then you got knocked over and had to make it up. Then Jaime spoiled things for you in Great Falls, and we had to make that up. But you always said when you got $10,000 ahead, you'd get out of this business, Bo.
You know what the interest on $10,000 would amount to, Bo said.
Even if you had it in 7% preferred stock, you'd only get $700 a year off it. How long could you live on $700?
But you've got more than $10,000. You've got 2 or 3 times that much.
You never figure right when you're down, Bo said. $10,000 looks like a million from where we used to be. But you can't get into any kind of business with only that kind of capital. You got to put up dough.
But you'll have to get out sometime, she said. It isn't fair to the kids. Bruce will be going to college this fall. What if you got into trouble and all his friends knew what you did? What if all Chet's friends knew it?
What do you want? He said, eyeing her somberly. Want me to sit on my tail and let what we've got dribble away?
You know what I want. I want you to find some business that we don't have to be ashamed of. The kids feel it, Bo. They don't like to bring their friends around the house. They have to lie about what you do. It isn't fair to them.
Well, I'm keeping my eyes open, he said. You can't just rush into a thing blind.
He moved impatiently and stood up at the rail to watch two boys ride hell for leather around the trail and out of sight into the woods.
Ho-hum, he said. Here I thought you'd be excited at the idea of another $1,000 socked away.
Did it ever occur to you, she said, her eyes on his, that there are things that would make me feel better than any amount of money.
Chapter 6 The game had started when Bo got there. He slipped the usher a $0.50 and moved down to a box on the first baseline. At the end of the fourth, Bill Talbot came out of the dugout to take a turn coaching at first, and Bo waved to him. After the third out, Bill came over.
"How's tricks?" he said. "Can't complain. Looks like you got a ball club this year." "They look pretty good, don't they?" Bill said. "You never saw a bunch of guys hit like these kids. If we had the pitching, we'd be in first place by 10 games."
"You're only 3 games off the pace. You can make that up."
"I got my fingers crossed," Bill said. "Anything stirring in your league?"
"Nothing except a favor I want to ask. Maybe you can't do it. I don't know."
"What is it?"
"You know that kid of mine?"
"The pitcher?"
I've been seeing his name in the Copper League, doing all right.
Doing pretty good, Bo said. I went out and caught him in the backyard one day. He's got a fast one that whistles, and a pretty good hook.
Bill bowed himself to spit carefully in the dust, and then erased the spit with his spikes.
What's the favor?
I was wondering if you could take the kid along on a road trip.
Bill shook his head.
Got my quota. We can't have any extras on the payroll after the middle of May.
Trouble is, Bo said, and bit the end off a cigar.
Trouble is the damn kid's got a crush on a girl, and I'd like to shake him loose till he cools off, and there's nothing he'd leave her for but maybe baseball.
Bill opened his mouth to laugh, raised his cap to cool his bald head, slipped it back on again.
You don't want me to put him on the team, then?
He isn't ready for that, hell no.
Tell you what, Talbot said. Would he come as bat boy, do you think?
I don't know. I should think so.
He wouldn't get any money, only expenses. But you can tell him I'll be looking him over. He could work out with the boys. Nobody'd fuss about that.
I should think that would do it, Bo said. He lighted the cigar and chuckled out a cloud of blue smoke. It would do him good to be a bat boy. He thinks he's ready to pitch to Ruth right now.
Tell him to come down and see me, Bill said. I'd like to get a longer look at him for a fact. We need pitchers so bad that even a green one with stuff looks pretty interesting. He might set himself up for a tryout next spring.
Good, Bo said. You leave next Monday?
Gone for 2 weeks, then back for two, then gone for three. He could go this trip or wait till the August one. What about his smelter job?
If I know him, Bo said, he'll throw that overboard in a minute, and the sooner he's got out of here, the better. He watched Bill go back to the coach's box at first, and after another inning, he rose and went home. He felt so good about the way he had used his influence to give Chet a chance, and at the same time to get him away from Laura, that he got out a bottle of scotch and wrapped it up and put it aside for Chet to take down to Bill when he went. His slight fear that Chet would stick up his nose at a bat boy's job lasted only the first minute of their conversation. Chet saw the possibilities all right.
"Jeez, let me at him," he said. "Did he say I could work out with them?"
"Yeah. He wants a look at your stuff. But he has to put you on as bat boy because his quota's full. You keep your eyes open and your mouth shut and try training a little, and you might get a break out of this boy. Bill's short of pitchers."
Chet looked up at the ceiling and cracked his knuckles together. "Maybe somebody'll get hurt and they'll have to put me in a game," he said.
"You won't get in any games," Bo said shortly.
"You're not on the team, for one thing. For another, you wouldn't last a third of an inning.
But you might learn something."
"If I don't, I'll kiss a pig," Chet said.
"Can I take the car now?"
Bo laughed. "Don't let any grass grow under you."
"Yeah, if you get it back here by 7.
"Okay.
What'll you do about the smelter?"
"That can fry," Chet said. "I can't pass this up just to pitch in that league."
"Then what'll you do all winter? Sit around on your tail?"
"That shows how much you know about it," Chet said. "I already lined up a job at the International Harvester. I'm going to play basketball for him this winter."
"Okay, okay," Bo said.
The kid had enough ambition. Wean him away from his Laura and he'd do all right.
"You better get along," he said. "Give this bottle to Bill."
Chet took it, stood in the doorway, jingling loose change in his pocket, looked up once, then out the door.
"Well, thanks, Pa,"
he said uncomfortably, and went out. He was back promptly in an hour.
"All fixed," he said,
and took a basketball shot at the top of a lamp with a sofa cushion. The lamp teetered and started to fall, and he leaped to grab it.
"Caught him and half the team at dinner," he said. "Bill said I could stick around till the end of the season if I wanted."
"I never saw anybody quite so overjoyed at getting a job as bat boy," Bo said.
"Stick around, boy," Chet said. "I'll be on that team when it starts training next spring."
A few minutes later, Bo heard him talking on the telephone in the hall. He held his paper still, listening.
"Yeah,"
Chet was saying.
"Bill wants to look me over this summer."
"No fooling."
"Yeah, Monday night."
No, just to look me over, sort of a preliminary tryout.
That's what I was thinking. You bet your life. I'll do what I can.
Old John can't go on catching forever. His legs are all shot.
I don't know why not.
I'll sure talk you up anyway. Tell him I can't pitch to anybody but you.